Honeycutt, and today I have with me, becoming a regular on the show, and I love it, Brett Thomaswick, director of golf, of course, at Sandpiper Bay. Welcome back again, buddy.
Good morning.
You're becoming quite the staple on the show.
Becoming on my calendar every week.
I love it.
In pen.
In pen?
Yes.
No pencil anymore.
Turn back down, my friend.
Good deal. I love it. I love it. Hey, dude, we didn't get to catch up.
There once were two men who grew up as friends in Spartanburg back in the day. The red-headed one was a preacher's son. The other's pa put you away. The time that they spent just came.
Hello, race fans. Welcome to the Scope Radio. Yes, our intro, I forgot that it didn't work last week, and I forgot to fix it. So I apologize to all you purists that are going to give me heck because I didn't have the proper intro for the show 2 weeks in a row. I'm sorry. Hope everybody's doing fine tonight. It would be just appropriate as could be for somebody to fuss about that because Hugh has not stopped fussing since he sat down tonight.
He hadn't stopped fussing since last week.
Come to think of it, I hadn't stopped fussing since the first time he walked in the studio.
You got it.
Yeah, the only difference was then we couldn't hardly get him to talk on the radio, and now we can't shut him up.
Well, he's a grouchy old man.
Yeah, yeah.
And you better believe it.
So, welcome, folks, to this Goat Rodeo. Let's get around and say hello to everybody, starting in Dawsonville, Georgia. The man, Cody Densmore, is with us. Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here. Good to see you, too.
Good to see you, too, man.
Yeah. I just can't get a good intro. I mean, that's all I know how to say.
Write it out and send it to me. I'll memorize it and get, you know, we'll get it down.
I'm saying for me, all I know how to say is good to see you, too.
Well, what's wrong with that?
You're pretty good at improvising everything else. You could do your segment on the fly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your segment about tonight? You don't know, do you?
Oh, it's on the fly, like you said.
All right, cool. All right. Speaking of on the fly, Tim Leeming is just east of there in the lair. How you doing, sir?
I am doing great. Thank you, Jefferson. Good to be with you all tonight on a wonderful Tuesday. Oh, before I forget it, I would like to have next Tuesday off. My grandson, Sam, is down to his last two soccer games before he graduates.
Man, what about that? That's a big milestone, ain't it?
Breaks my heart. I mean, he grew up so fast, it's just unbelievable.
That's amazing. That's cool. Well, buddy, we'll miss you, but have fun. Think about us while you're out there.
No, I will.
Yeah, you won't either.
I hate to miss the shows, but, you know, the way this has been unfolding for him this season, it's been up and down, but he's, I think, the 10th-rated player in the state.
You can,
which is not bad.
Tim, you can write it, and Devin can read it.
Yeah, it's true.
And there you go.
What, the legendorial? Oh, I'll probably give you a legendorial next week anyway. I try to do that when I'm not here.
Is your grandson going to play college ball or not?
No, the remarkable thing is he told us at the start of this soccer season that when he graduates, he is going to be totally 100% dedicated to his college work. Sam is real smart, but it's hard for him in school because he's just like me. He doesn't test well. He knows the material, but he just doesn't test well. But he and three of his teammates are heading to the College of Charleston, so I'm sure they'll be having a riotous time there.
Yeah, that sounds good, man. Exciting times for them, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very.
Coastal Jack Walker has joined us back in the studio again this week. He was on Skype with us last week. Welcome back, CJ.
Hey, glad to be back. I'll probably be on Skype next week, actually. Oh, yeah. I hadn't told you that yet, but probably. I'm going through a little eye problem and can't have my contacts in for a while, so want to be driving at night.
So we got a Carolina Race Place historic race finish.
Oh, yeah.
Where are we going tonight, man?
Man, we are going to a place Cody would like, Atlanta International Raceway.
What year?
1960.
Wow. Oh, long reach back.
That's getting back there now.
Yeah, man.
And I forgot to ask Tim. Tim, what's the legendorial about tonight?
Oh, the legendorial tonight is entitled Opinions Matter Only to the Opinion Holder.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. You and those titles. I like it. Right. The Bopper is here, all the way from Charlotte, North Carolina, the home of Bobby's Auto Parts, which is the home of the Endless Warranty. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Doing good.
Man,
doing
that's
real
good.
Yeah. Good to be here. Good to see you.
Good
too.
To have you, man.
Yeah.
Good to have you. Did you race this last week?
Kind of. I raced for three laps.
Three laps? Hey, that's a start.
Hey, that's the most you've raced in a while.
In a while, yeah.
Yeah, that's the most you've raced in several months.
Yeah, I'll save the details for a later segment.
That is, he's letting us know
just
what
a little,
the segment's
little
about.
Teaser.
Little teaser, there it is. You got it. Speaking of a teaser, the Splitter's here.
Yes, he is.
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing just fine.
You got something for us tonight? That would be. Oh, he wrote it sideways.
Hey, it printed. there's more story to getting it on paper than there is on paper.
Are you Chinese? Is that so? What happened, man? You wrote.
Like I just don't get along well with computers.
Son, who do you get along? What do you get along well with?
And who?
You know, Leonardo da Vinci wrote in his notebook left-handed and backwards.
Did he?
Yeah. So he had to read it looking in a mirror.
Is that what you think this looks like?
That's what it reminds me of, Leonardo of Venice.
So Leonardo Splitter.
Yeah, yeah. Leonardo Splitter.
Well, I sat down at the computer and wrote out what I thought was a real nice piece. And then I tried to print it.
Yep.
And that turned into a 30-minute adventure.
Man, that stuff is tough for an old guy, ain't it?
Believe me. And you'll notice half of it is in
it's upside down.
Because it wouldn't. No.
Give
well,
up
okay,
and
no.
hand wrote it. Give up and hand wrote it.
It's in longhand because
show,
the,
show
the,
Bobby. He's got the paper taped together.
Yeah, he showed. And the computer ate the really good part. Yeah. You had the hand right there.
Oh, that's right. Goodness. The last half of it didn't print and wasn't there after I tried to print it. I don't know what happened.
So you guys don't have any idea what it takes to put this show together and what these guys go through. Every week, just to bring you
like herding cats.
Bring you like herding cat, just to bring you an hour show. Yeah, and to think we used to fill 2 hours.
And if it weren't for Cody, the median age here would be in the upper 60s.
Yeah, way upper 60s.
Cody brings that down a little bit.
Blows the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, Cody, you blew the curve on that. That's good, though. Thank you.
We try to be help very much indebted to Cody.
All right. So somebody take it away. What happened this weekend in the world of racing?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Well, on the NASCAR front, nothing.
On the NASCAR front, nothing.
Okay.
Bobby, you can tell us about Dublin. You were there.
You want to lead off tonight, Bobby? That's your segment, isn't it?
Well, the Bell & Bell Vintage Series did have our opening race of the 2017 season this Saturday night at Dublin, and we had 17 cars in the pits, and what did we have, Hugh? 19 drivers?
19 drivers, 17 cars.
Yeah. Of course, only 16 made it to the starting grid because I was the 17th one and had difficulties in practice. Over the winter, I had been busily installing a 3-link rear suspension.
Is that legal?
Yep. Well, it kind of is.
It is as long as I'm steward.
Yeah.
But the guy that invented the 3-link rear suspension supposedly was looking at the back of a farm tractor.
I get that.
And noticed that, well, only 3 links hold up whatever you got it hooked to. You know, it can't go up, it can't do anything, but still it has a lot of articulation. And so that was that's the same basic principle you do in a car. It has 2 bottom links and 1 top link and a Panhard bar and everything to keep it.
A Panhard bar keeps it from going side to side.
Going side to side. On pavement, you want it to be relatively stable with not a lot of wild gyrations. But on dirt, you want it to move. You want the rear end to move and create rear steer so you don't make the lower bars. They're not necessarily parallel. They're not even necessarily the same length. And in theory, it should all articulate and help steer the rear of the car. But when it does all that, the rear end literally moves, and so the drive shaft has to have a certain range of motion because it's going to be moving also. And I knew all that, but you also don't exactly know how much travel to allow for the drive shaft. I mean, there ain't no book to go look at it. If you're putting in a 3-link in a 37 Plymouth, you need to add 3.2 inches of drive shaft travel. So it's just kind of seat of the pants.
So what did you do? Yank the yoke out?
Well, I don't know yet. In practice, I'll tell you one thing. She felt good. It was flying. I mean, everything was going. The whole car drives different when you have when the rear end's steering you around. That's just a whole different feeling than a conventional setup. But I was kind of, it was sort of getting semi comfortable, and I just going down the front stretch. A big calamity erupted underneath the floorboard. Bam, boom, 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 and I knew what it was. Instantly, the car.
Having felt that feeling before, even in the hauler.
The good thing is you had a loop, right?
Yeah, had a loop.
And it didn't pole vault you into the stand.
You had your drive shaft painted white.
Yeah, had it painted white.
Oh, man.
So and you can find it.
Boom, 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 boom. I coasted all the way back to the third turn. I kept moving the shift, trying to get her to go, letting, mash it in the clutch, putting her, make sure she was in gear and letting out, and nothing happened. And so I knew what the deal was, and the little Jeep man, he come and pushed me in, and he'd found the drive shaft all at the same time. So
yeah, he picked up the drive shaft, then come pushed you in.
Yep. So anyway, in the course of the drive shaft, and I don't know at this point, I hadn't really looked under there if the drive shaft came out of the transmission and flopped around and done the damage, or if it tried to go in and I didn't have enough clearance, for it to slide forward. I don't know which one of those scenarios, but the end result was kind of the same. The drive shaft came loose and tore up the back of the transmission and all such as that. So anyway, that pretty much ended my night. But we had that still left us with a good field. And the highlight, there was a lot of stories, but the big story, this story actually started 41 years ago. 41 years ago, before I was married, my fiance and me, we went on a date one night. She lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I took her, and she acted like she liked it.
Notice that acted like part.
That's the marriage ensued.
Yeah, we weren't even married, but we went to the old Fayetteville Speedway. It don't even exist no more. It's a ghost track and a cemetery, real ghost track. And anyway, the old Fayetteville Speedway, and there was this guy that was just flying. His name was Carl Smith, driving in the six-cylinder class, and he had an orange Camaro, orange with a white top. It was number 4. I don't know how I remember all these details. It's funny what you remember 41 years later. But I remember he was just the class of the field, so I remembered the name. And late last year in the 2016 campaign, the same Carl Smith shows up wanting to get into Bell and Bell Vintage Racing, really? And gets in. All on his, he learns about us. I'm not really sure how. Finds a car in Alabama on his own power, a vintage car, goes down and gets it, and so on, brings it back. Races with us the last race of last year, just an acclimation.
Did you know who he was at that time?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, at that time. He's 73 years old. So he drove, last year about like I would have expected. But this Saturday night, they was there, and he drew the pole for he's in our senior division. And there was 9 cars in this race, and Pete Corey, who's been racing with us off and on forever, drew the outside pole. And at the drop of the green, Pete got the jump and stretched out to two or three or four car lead or something, and I figured that was pretty much going to be that. But after two or three laps, here comes Carl Smith. 73-year-old Carl, running him down. And he followed him for a lap or two. And passed him. I mean, passed him. Which is hard to do.
Well, especially Pete Corey.
Yeah, which is real hard to do. And then proceeded to, I mean, he didn't run off and leave him, but he got to five or six cars.
He was comfortably ahead and stayed there.
And Pete was doing everything he could do to try to catch him.
He finally run into the, well, kind of sort of run into the wall.
And Carl was very much in control of the race and the car and everything. And won the race in convincing fashion. And I just ran the victory lane. It was like a I couldn't have been no more happy if I had a won. This was a dream of mine in the beginning of vintage racing. Was what about if some old time drivers through this venue could come back to race and come back to win? This was a kind of a pipe dream scenario, and it actually happened. He was so tickled, so overcome with all of it. He couldn't hardly get out of the car, and when he got out, he literally couldn't stand up. He was just physically spent. We had to hold him up and support him and everything, and we had to tried to find a golf cart so he could get back to his pit area. We finally found a four wheeler, but it was just a mountaintop type of experience for that kind of thing to happen.
And yeah, that's cool, man.
And for
So does Pete Corey still have the engine back in his driver's compartment?
Yes.
Holy cow.
And he sits at the back end of that coupe so far back that he can't see the flagman for the roof of his car.
kind of like the old Glenn Wood coach, only with the coach you could see out of the rear windows.
Yeah. He sits so far back in there that he can't see up at all.
Yeah.
And he can't see the flag stand when he goes
can't
by.
See the flag
he cannot
stand
tell
at all.
What flag the flagman's waving. Because he's that so far behind the windshield, he can't
see up.
But anyway, about Mr. Carl called me, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. I just wanted to tell you, hey.
Yeah.
And in the course of talking, he told me that him and his son had driven their tow truck and empty trailer to Miami, Florida, to look at another vintage car and possibly, you know, buy it. They had was equipped to tow it back home, back to the Fayetteville area. Got all the way to Miami. And he said that thing was just cobbled together, old welded up angle iron and mess. He said there was no way I was gonna drag that home. And he didn't. He just made a dry run.
And you know the guy who had the car sees the fella show up with a trailer driving from wherever he's from, saying, well, I got this deal.
Yep. Yeah.
No sure sense negotiating. That's a done deal.
And he left him holding the bag. But that's pretty dedicated to drive to Miami in a van, box van and a trailer.
Heck yeah, man.
And then not get the car. But the way he run the other, he really did not need another car. He's
nope.
Got this one figured out. So that was
He put on a show.
Yep, that's my highlight. That might be the highlight of the year, except he could win some more.
That's cool. That's good stuff, man.
So, 73 years old, still getting it done.
That is very, very cool. Yep. Very cool. Cody, light us up, man. What you got?
All right. I figured I'd talk about Bristol.
All right. Cool. Let's talk about Bristol, one of my favorite subjects.
So I didn't know this until researching it a little while ago. Of how many owners Bristol has had it within the last 50 some odd years. So it could have opened in 1961 under a different name. The first proposed site for the Speedway was Piney Flats, Tennessee, but according to Carl Moore, who built the track, along with Larry Carrier and R.G. Pope, the idea met local opposition. So the track could have been called Piney Flats International Speedway, which probably wouldn't have.
Piney Flats 500.
Yeah, I don't really see that still having the same name today.
Piney Flats is still there, I promise you. It's just that it's a suburb of Bristol. Bluntville, actually. Yeah.
I'd imagine it's pretty small.
It's pretty small, yep.
Let's see. So what could have been called Piney Flats was built 5 miles up the road off of Highway 11E, land upon Bristol, which was formerly part of Gray's Dairy. At one point was one of the largest dairies in the eastern United States. So the builders of the track traveled to Charlotte in 1960 to watch a race, and they decided that they need to build their own speedway in Tennessee, but they wanted a smaller version of Charlotte. So work began on the on Bristol in 1960 took approximately 1 year to finish. They scratched many ideas for the track before it became what it is known as today. So the first initial race, which was held on July 30th, 1961, held 18,000 people. The first driver on track for practice in 1961 was Tiny Lund driving a Pontiac. Second driver out was David Pearson. Lorenzen won the pole for the first race at Bristol with a speed of 79.25 miles an hour. Atlanta's Jack Smith driving a Pontiac won the inaugural event, the Volunteer 500. However, Smith was not in the driver's seat of the Pontiac when the race ended. He drove the first 290 laps, then had to have Johnny Allen, also Atlanta, take over as his relief driver. The two shared the $3,200 purse. The total purse of the race was $16,000. A total of 42 cars started the first race at Bristol, but only 19 finished. Which I was actually looking earlier, and there's only 39 cars entered for this weekend, and that's kind of a common theme. I think the only race this year that's had over 39 drivers has been Daytona. I think those were 41 or 42 entries, so haven't had a full field in quite some time. Excuse me. In 1969, Bristol was reshaped and remeasured. The turns were then banked at 36 degrees and became a half-mile oval. The track was sold after the 1976 season to Lanny Hester and Gary Baker. In the spring of 78, the track name was changed to Bristol International Raceway. In August that year, the first night race was held on the oval. It will now become one of the most popular and highly anticipated events on the schedule. And on April the 1st of 82, Lanny Hester sold half of his operation to Warner Hodgdon. On July 6, 1983, Hodgdon completed a 100% purchase of Bristol as well as Nashville Speedway. And then less than two years later, on January the 11th of 85, Hodgdon filed for bankruptcy. Which I think that's going to be one of my future topics, is Warner Hodgdon and who he was and how he owned half a NASCAR seat, pretty much. I think he had several tracks and Lord knows how many cars had his name on the side of it. And it was only for just a couple of years and he was gone, it seemed like. So in 1992, the track was sold to Bruton Smith, which continues to own it now, where they bumped up the seating from 118,000 and now can hold 160,000. Wonder when the last time it's been packed. Does anybody know what the seating arrangements are for Bristol the last few years? If they've
it's down several thousand seats. I don't know what it is, but
no, I'm saying like how many do they hold now?
Yeah, it's down. They've removed some seats from what I understand. I don't know what it is, but so can I go back and ask you a question? I was reading something, looking for something when you were talking about the ownership changes. So when Carl Moore eventually became state senator, East Tennessee, Senator Carl Moore. When that track sold the first time, Larry Carrier was still involved all the way through, right? Until it sold to Bruton Smith.
Yeah, he was. Larry Carrier was the owner at the time when he sold to Bruton Smith.
Okay, yeah, and I was just I'll go back to what you said there in just a second. We'll go look at the seating capacity, but I was reading something here about Carl Moore, and here's what he said. He said they drew up the plans for the racetrack on a napkin because at the time Carl Moore owned the bowling alley. And he says, Larry called me up. He said, must have been 1960 or something, and Carl recalls. He says, in Charlotte, there's a race, and you've got to get over here because there's 50,000 people paying $20 a ticket to watch these cars go around in circles. And they borrowed $600,000 and built the track.
Wow, I bet it took them a minute to pay that back.
So anyway, now back to the I'm going to Google Bristol seating capacity while you.
Sure.
Do everything with Google and you'll know what it is.
Remember there was plans to make a dome over Bristol?
Yep. Which would be pretty cool if they ever did that.
Now, I don't know if there was actually plans. There was discussion.
There was some serious discussion about it.
I think one of the most interesting things about Bristol was the dirt track that they built on.
Yeah.
For, what was it, 2 years or 3 years they done it in the early 2000s?
It was at least 2 years.
But that was really interesting. I love watching some of the old videos of it. And I would guess to say that probably is the reason they wanted to repave it in, I believe, 07 or 08, because it probably destroyed the racing surface a good bit. But they trucked in about, what was it, 14,000 loads of dirt for it?
That experiment is what convinced the Bruton Smith Group to build the dirt tracks at Charlotte and Vegas and wherever else they have them.
Texas.
But that was they were impressed with the Bristol experience and decided to add, you know, just standalone dirt.
Didn't they start off doing some football games inside of Bristol also?
They talked about it. I don't know whether it ever materialized, but they certainly, because they said that the stands were of such configuration that they could have football games in the infield.
Well, they had one this past fall.
Yeah, but didn't they start off years ago doing that also?
I don't ever remember hearing that.
I think they did.
I'll look and see if I can find it. But
I mean, who cares?
The seating capacity and got to 160,000. And for the football game last year, the Tennessee-Virginia Tech, they showed the capacity at 150,000, and they were seating people down on the field to make that happen, you know, the field level. So I don't know what. I'm trying to find something that gives me a current capacity. I'm not finding anything specific for it, but I know I'd heard that they hit, that it was no longer, that it got to like 160,000, and they've taken some seats out.
I'm just curious as to how many people attend it now. Like, what's been its peak in the last few years? Because, you know, I know it ain't been that much.
Well, it certainly appears to be one of the fullest venues when you watch TV, and of course we look for things like that, but it seems that the seats are the most occupied at Bristol of any of the tracks to me. They're not full, but
Jeff, remember in the very early days of Racers Reunion there was a contest went on where you won two tickets to the night race at Bristol.
Yes, sir.
When it was still highly.
Yeah, they were sold out. You had
valuable.
Yeah, we got that from Keebler and Kellogg's. Sponsored that deal. A friend of mine was a representative for Keebler and Kellogg's, and provided those tickets. Yep.
And when Bristol first started, they had weekly modified sportsman races.
They were weekly.
Yep.
Nope.
Or biweekly. Very often. I mean, Bill Morton was like the track champion there 1 year.
Cody mentioned that when they made the dirt track out of it, that the racing surface may have suffered. I don't mean to disagree, but for years at Bowman Gray in Winston, they literally made a dirt track out of theirs for flat track motorcycle racing, and they did it on Saturday nights. They would run a half a card of regular asphalt racing, and at intermission they would literally convert it to a dirt track and run flat track motorcycles on it the last half of the seat of the night.
How'd they bring in that much dirt that quick?
Very quickly. Lots of dump trucks and lots of equipment.
Must have been lots of cold beer too.
Of course, it was only a quarter mile.
It was a quarter mile, and it was flat.
How deep would the dirt be?
About 6 inches, 6 or 8 inches.
That's a lot of dirt.
It had to be clay or something.
Yeah, they brought. Of course, there's lots of clay in Forsyth County, but they brought clay in, mixed it with sand, and had a great big pile literally in the parking lot of the stadium, and they one of the grading and hauling companies brought apparently all of their equipment, and they had a big front end loader and loaded the dump trucks up and had them sitting at the edge of the track. And when the last checkered flag fell for the asphalt card, they dropped the clutch on the first dump truck who pulled out on the track and hoisted the bed and dumped it out. And there was a motor grader right there spreading it out. And just an endless stream of dump trucks dump their load and pull around and pull out and go get another load. And it didn't take them but about an hour, I guess, from start to finish, and they were ready. As soon as they finished putting all the dirt down, they brought a big tractor trailer out loaded with bales of straw and put straw bales up against the Armco on the outside so that if the cyclists fell off, they wouldn't impact the Armco guardrail.
Wow.
And those flat track motorcycle guys put on a show too. But
they wet it and packed it down and all that kind of stuff?
It was already wet. Wet's not the word. Damp.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to do anything, but they spread it out with a motor grader and then rolled it with the same kind of roller that they pack asphalt when they put it down. It was a well-orchestrated operation, I'll tell you that.
Must have been.
So, Cody, did you still have more, or did we just hijack you right in the middle? Go ahead.
No, that's all right.
So, what does it say? Everything's great?
Yeah. The only other thing I was going to mention was the, I can't remember what it's called, but next month when it's like the Southeastern Short Track group will go to Bristol. I'm really excited about that, and a friend of mine from down here is going up, and he said there was, you know, they put a limit on how many cars can go because there's so much interest.
Talking about the National Short Track
races, yeah.
May 25th or something like that, 25th, 26th.
Are you going?
I don't know. I'd love to. I don't think I can make it, though. But I will be watching it on Speed 51 because they're going to broadcast it live.
Where is it being
Bristol.
Hosted at?
Bristol.
Oh, that's that three.
Yeah, the late models, the Car Series, the Southern Super Series, and the CRA Series are together doing the late models and the super late models. And then they
What's
also
the date
have modifieds. It's like May 25th, May 24th, right in there somewhere.
Yeah, I believe it's on Memorial Day weekend, I think.
Cool.
But it's going to be a huge event. I mean, they had over 500 entries.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yep. All right. You finished, Cody?
I am.
Okay. Tim, take it away, bud.
Okay. The legendarial for April 18th is entitled Opinions Matter Only to the Opinion Holder. Using a conservative expression of a very well-known statement about opinions, opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone has one. Having said that, the next thing I expect to hear is a report from a nursery in Namibia that a baby was born without one. I would certainly not be surprised. Tonight's legendarial will be a short one because last week I felt as though my contribution to the show shortchanged Bopper and you. The legendarial was too long, and the discussion afterwards, although I applaud that discussion, took up time which should have belonged to Hugh and Bopper. We all know opinions, especially those regarding politics, religions, and favorite car brands, can cause heated arguments, sometimes resulting in violence. I sincerely believe my contribution last week was a positive statement about the hope and future of our sport. Granted, most of the panel seemed to agree with most of what I said, but it was an email the next morning that went into great lengths disputing almost everything I said. I had no idea Ryan Blaney was the son of multi-billionaire with a B, Dave Blaney, who bought him the ride in the 21. Oh, I knew Dave was the dad, I just didn't know about the billions. I was also unaware that Rick Hedrick made a deal with Bill Elliott the day Chase was born to take over the kid's life and make a race driver out of him. As for Kyle Larson, who knew his family owns hundreds of thousands of acres of prime real estate in both Los Angeles and Tokyo? I certainly didn't. Actually, none of that is true, but while certain privileges may exist for those young men that don't exist for others, I think what they have shown in talent proves it is more than about the money. Frankly, I'm tired of the discussions about money. I'm tired of discussions about NASCAR's money, or soon to be lack thereof. I want to see racing. I want to see drivers with talent provide that racing. That, frankly, is my opinion of where we are and where we are going. If you wish to express a different opinion, email me at idontreallywanttohearit@kma.net. Now, back to Jeff, you, Cody, Jack, and Bumper.
Did you say F-U?
No, I did not say that. I said you can email me at idontreallywanttohearit@kma.net.
But what'd you say after that? Back to you.
Back to Jeff Hugh.
Oh, Jeff
Cody,
Hugh.
Jack,
I thought he
Bumper.
Said F U.
That's what you wanted to read into it.
I mean, you know, I didn't know. I was just checking. Thank you, Tim. That was a very short legendorial.
Well, it was done on purpose because I really felt bad last week when we ran out of time and Bopper didn't even get, I don't think he got 2 minutes worth in.
I don't think that hurts any of our feelings.
Well,
all right.
Not mine.
Up next, the man on the street with a sideways, upside down Chinese arithmetic paper. Read, see if you can read that stuff to us, Hugh.
That's the whole thing is I'm a terrible
Hugh's
reader.
Views on the news.
All right. Since there was no NASCAR race this weekend, it gave me time to reflect on races in times past. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and started my love of racing at Bowman Gray Stadium, a flat quarter-mile asphalt oval. It's been there for as long as most of us can remember. Was one of the first NASCAR tracks. Alvin Hawkins was the first promoter, and his family is still the track's promoter to this day. A lot of big-name drivers have graced the track in Winston, and I feel privileged to have grown up watching a lot of these NASCAR stars in my own backyard. A lot has happened in the 60-plus years that I have been a NASCAR fan, and we have seen the sports rise to heights no one could have imagined back when Big Bill France held that infamous meeting at the Streamline Hotel back in the late 40s after the war. When racing had no direction except the local Saturday night promoters, at least no real organization. With the coming of NASCAR, at least the sport of racing had a governing body with some semblance of organization. I watched it grow and was happy to see the sport prosper. Then came the sponsorship of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, and boy, what a change. The coming of the Winston Cup was the crowning piece of the puzzle. With big-name sponsor, it grew into to inconceivable heights. The stands were full. The fans wanted to see their driver win. Then the government got involved, and the Reynolds sponsorship ended. About the government being involved. And the sport began to fall and start a long downhill slide. Some say to total failure. Maybe so. But surely something, someone, will come along to fill the void. And I only hope that it's bigger and better than what we have had for the last few years. What do y'all think?
Yeah, you.
Way to go, Hugh. You got it out, man. That's good.
That was.
I actually read most of the words.
That's one of the best ones you've ever done, my friend.
The good thing about writing your own content is you can always just write words that you know how to pronounce. Right?
There you go.
That's right. Yeah. You read somebody else's stuff, you just never know what you might come up on.
That's right. And don't ever write the words that you don't know the meaning of.
That's true. Yeah. All right, Coastal Jack Walker, let's take it to the Carolina Race Place Historic Race Finish.
All righty. This week, we are going to Atlanta International Raceway. The new Atlanta International Raceway opened on July 31st, 1960. The first race over the 1.5-mile banked oval was the Dixie 300 Grand National Race, won by Fireball Roberts. 3 months later, Atlanta International Raceway would hold the first annual Atlanta 500 Grand National Race on October 30th, 1960. The day before the Atlanta 500, on Saturday, October 29th, the track held its second race on the new speedway. This was a 150-mile, 100-lap NASCAR National Championship Modified Sportsman event with a purse of $8,200. The first day of time trials for the 150-mile Modified Sportsman race was held on Thursday. Only 7 cars made time trial runs on that day. Banjo Matthews, driving a 1959 Sportsman Ford, usually driven by Carl Burris, won the pole position with a speed of 126.139 miles per hour. Fireball Roberts, driving a modified 1956 Ford, had the second fastest lap, earning him the outside front row starting position. The balance of the field would qualify on Friday. On Saturday, it appears that only 23 cars took the green flag for the 150-mile race. Fireball Roberts took the lead on the first lap. Roberts was closely followed by Banjo Matthews. They swapped the lead back and forth until lap 30, when Fireball's day came to an end with a blown motor. At that point, Banjo Matthews took over the lead. On lap 60, Buck Baker, who had been running in the middle of the field, began to make his way towards the front. Baker was driving the same number 87 1950 Oldsmobile that he helped build 10 years earlier. On lap 90, Banjo Matthews was still leading. He was followed by Jimmy Thompson, driving the number 50 Marion Cox 1955 Modified Ford, and Buck Baker in the number 87 Modified Oldsmobile. On that same lap, Jimmy Thompson blew a tire, hit the guardrail, and turned over several times before coming to a stop on the track apron. This brought out the only caution flag of the race. Thompson was rushed to the hospital before being released with only minor injuries. On lap 95, the race returned to green with Banjo Matthews leading, but that only lasted one lap. On lap 96, Matthews pulled into the pits out of the race with a burned piston. Buck Baker took over the lead and 4 laps later got the checkered flag. He finished almost a full lap ahead of the second place car. This was the first modified race Baker had run since 1955. So here's the way they finished, as far as I know, October 29th, 1960, 150-mile modified sportsman race in Atlanta. The winner, number 87, Buck Baker, Charlotte, North Carolina, a 1950 Oldsmobile modified, followed by Bill Wimble, Lisbon, New York, and a 55 Ford modified, Sonny Black, Forest Park, Georgia, a 1939 Chevrolet modified, Gil Hearn, Miami, Florida, a 57 Chevy modified, Woody Coleman, Roswell, Georgia, a 1957 modified, Chevy modified, finishing 6th, Banjo Matthews, Asheville, North Carolina, a 59 Ford Sportsman, Gerald Duke, College Park, Georgia, a 37 Ford modified, Gober Sosby, Atlanta, Georgia, a 57 Chevy Sportsman, finishing 9th, Bobby Allison, Hueytown, Alabama, a 36 Chevrolet modified, finishing 10th, the number 50 of Jimmy Thompson, Monroe, North Carolina, a 55 Ford modified. Otis Gaither, Chattanooga, Tennessee, a 57 Pontiac modified. Wendell Scott, Danville, Virginia, a 37 Ford modified. Carl Tyler, Holly Hill, Florida, a 54 Ford Sportsman. Cotton Wallace, Atlanta, Georgia, a 37 Chevrolet modified. Coming in 15th, Dave Mater, Homewood, Alabama, a 57 Chevy modified. Sam Jones, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, a 39 Ford modified. Freddie Fryer, Rossville, Georgia, a 55 Chevy modified. Earl Brooks, Lynchburg, Virginia, a 40 Ford modified. Coming in 19th, Fireball Roberts, Daytona Beach, Florida, and a 56 Ford modified. Tiny Lund, Cross, South Carolina, a 57 Chevy modified. Mike Price, Atlanta, Georgia, a 37 Plymouth Sportsman. Martin Sharp, Atlanta, Georgia, and finishing 23rd in what I believe to be the final car, Ralph Smith, Roswell, Georgia, a 57 Chevy. I could find no information saying there was any more than 23 cars in the race, even though it was open to 46 starters. So I think it was probably a big flop, but pretty much a cool event. The was second race on the speedway.
A neat field.
Yeah. So, what'd you see, Bobby?
I can't help but think that the 59 Ford that Banjo Matthews would have had to have been a Thunderbird. I just can't believe it. I guess it could have been a 59 Ford, but
yep. But not likely.
Here's what I can't figure out. It says in two different articles it said 59 Ford. I don't think a 59 Ford could run in this, right? Yeah, I'm betting it was a 54 Ford.
Yeah, because he ran a like a 54, 55
Carl
Ford.
Burris won at Daytona in a 54 Ford, so I'm thinking it's 54.
Yeah, I don't
think. This says two different articles that called it a 59 Ford.
Because this was only 1960, it would have been a Euro. It would have been a Grand National.
Yeah, it would have been a Grand National car.
Exactly.
That's
what I was thinking. And matter of fact, one article I had said that Baker won at Lakewood. it was crazy.
Well, you find, and you've done enough research to know that the articles that you read vary wildly from what you know to be reality, or at least.
Well, a lot of these guys, Dargan Watts is a good example of that. He told me he wrote for years articles talking about the races at Sumter from his home in Ocala, Florida.
Yeah,
you know, not being at the race, he'd do it secondhand information. Now, I think a lot of these articles were the same way.
You know that all these
speaking of Carl Burris,
reporters
54 Ford, right?
Yeah.
Let me see that.
So, Cody, if you have any information on this at the Georgia Hall of Fame, I'd sure love to see it on this particular race.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can do some digging for you, but those are some very interesting names. A lot of the guys on there that didn't really make it far in their racing career were in this
yes.
race. So I really enjoyed hearing those names.
Yeah, Gerald Dukes, man, he had a cool 1959 Thunderbird in the Grand National Series for a while.
And there's Dave Mader, who's...
And I don't know what Dave Mader, that's one, two, or three.
Ultimately come the third, Dave Mader the third.
And I would suspect, although I don't know, that the Marion Cox Jimmy Thompson 55 Ford out of the Marion Cox stable was probably the original Grand National car that Marion Cox had.
Was that the one that got wrecked so bad to hit the wall and turned
over? I bet you that's what it was. And Wendell Scott, a 37 Ford.
That was one thing about these cars. They were handed from series to series to series back when they could run the same chassis in each of the series, which is kind of sad that they can't do that today.
Yeah. But even though I couldn't dig up a tremendous amount of information on this, I thought it was pretty cool to kind of document it and talk about it
a little bit. That's a little-known event.
Yeah, a little-known event.
Well,
the second race on the speedway.
All y'all are talking about Carl Burris. He was a regular at Bowman Gray and was not very well liked. I'm being very, very polite.
How about Sam Jones from Winston-Salem?
I don't remember that, but I'm thinking that was probably Pee Wee Jones's father. I caught that. And I thought for a moment, I don't recognize that Sam.
You don't
Sam,
think Pee Wee's real name was Sam, do you?
I don't, probably, possibly not. I don't know. That might prompt a little bit of research on my part between now and next week. But I never heard him referred to in Winston as anything but Pee Wee Jones, and that's the reason I assumed it. Of course, that was in what, 1960?
1960.
Don't know.
And the guy that finished 11th, Otis Gaither from Chattanooga, Tennessee, at 57 Pontiac Modified. I remember in the Myrtle Beach paper there was a big article about him going to be at Ramby Raceway for one of the races probably in about 1960 or 61. He never did show up.
Just to update the Pee Wee Jones story.
All right.
Pee Wee Jones was born Philip Sylvester Jones, was a legend in the world of NASCAR. He was one of the original members of NASCAR when it was founded in 1949 by Bill France. So Pee Wee Jones is, at least his name is not Samuel.
Right.
Samuel Jones.
What was the problem with Carl Burris?
He wasn't a very polite driver.
Oh, okay.
What does that mean?
He was commonly referred to as a very dirty driver. Mm. He would put you in the wall in a heartbeat.
A couple of these events that I have attended over the years, his name would come up, and it didn't matter who was speaking it. It was always with great disdain.
Let me put it to you this way. I saw him involved in a very bad wreck one night. Somebody, his car spun. He was sitting on the infield right at the edge of the track facing the wrong direction. Two more cars got into it, and one hit his car head on and jumped up over the hood, and the front axle went all the way to the windshield, which could have potentially been fatal. That was a really bad wreck. And the result in the stands were the most of the fans got up and cheered. If that gives you any idea, Carl Burris' popularity.
Is he still living?
I don't know. He hasn't raced at Bowman Gray in years and years and years, but...
Here's Carl Burris' obituary.
Oh, okay. That tells you.
I guess he's not living.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of Carl Burris's, as it turns out. The real Carl Burris.
Please stand up. Bobby, you remember my first reaction when I saw that Carl Burris copy show up at one of our very first vintage modified races.
Jim Wilmore
car is a direct copy of Carl Burris's car. And the first question I asked him when I was introduced, are you kin to Carl Burris? He said, no, I just thought the car was cool.
Actually, it's the Mason's Garage car, which Carl Burris drove at one time.
Yep.
He was from Leakesville.
Leakesville Spray Draper.
Bobby, did you have more?
Me? No, I did not.
We're just rambling.
We can ad lib.
Ad lib. We got 8 minutes.
Jeff, have you got anything?
No. Oh, I'll add something else to this.
All right.
That 1950 Oldsmobile that Buck Baker won this race in, the last I've heard, or last I knew, that car was still in Columbia, South Carolina.
Is that the one in the museum, the Joe Weatherly car?
Same car, but I think it was still brought back to Columbia, and it's in a warehouse in Columbia. What's that guy's name? I met that guy one time. I can't remember his name. But
that car has quite a history.
Oh, absolutely. Lee Petty drove it in the modified race at Daytona that same year.
Yeah, several people have drove that over the years. Yeah. And it might have even run in the Southern 500 at the time.
It did, yes.
Now, what year, what make
of 1950 Oldsmobile.
50 Olds.
And that was
white.
I know which
number
car
87. Yeah.
And that was really in the early 50s. That was the car of choice.
Yes.
It was, for its age, it was pretty aero. Yep. It had a really high potential V8 engine. There was just a lot of good involved in those cars. What does anybody here know what kind of transmissions they ran in them? Because most of the cars that you saw on the street had automatic transmissions, even in 50. But I do know that in 49 and 50, Oldsmobile still offered a straight drive. Mm. And I'm assuming that they didn't run an automatic.
Some of them might have. Yeah.
Well, since it was modified, there's no telling what it had.
Yeah, or it could have had any kind of transmission in it.
Or engine.
Yeah. Well, engine too, for that matter. But the Oldsmobile was pretty stout for its day.
Yeah, it was a good race car, but you're not talking about the automatic transmission situation. When the Pettys tried that, what was it, in 63, 62 or 63?
Riverside.
Yeah, at Riverside, they came out with this, all this publicity. It was the first time an automatic transmission had been run in NASCAR, blah, 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 because I remember all that hoopla.
Yeah, I do too.
And also remember, I think it was the transmission that put him out of the race, wasn't it, Bobber?
I think so. I think that was the first time they went to Riverside, which was about 63. The Petties tried to.
Didn't the Petties also do air conditioning the first time? Weren't they
59,
the first one?
Well, they were. Weren't they the very first ones to run power steering? Also,
I don't know that one.
I think so.
Jeff Bodine was the
Jeff Bodine was
the one on the.
That was in 83 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the Petties put air conditioning in the cars in 59, found out that didn't work too good.
Now, as far as I know, the only car to win a NASCAR with automatic was the Chrysler 300 to Tim Pluck in 55 at Daytona Beach. Because Fireball won the race in a Buick, but he was disqualified, and Tim could never get him out of the turns because it wouldn't downshift. So Fireball was disqualified, and it was handed to Tim Pluck.
Huh. Now, was that just a one-on deal, or did they run the automatic transmission in all the Chryslers that year? Because Carl
Kite, I think they all had automatic.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Well, then that's when you had to run whatever it came from
it
the
came
factory.
It came from the factory, yes.
Well, then I would say this was the first time.
There you go.
Because I know that one, but, you know, like I said, it all, I know Tim Pluck won 18 races that season, and I know the Keykafer cars won over half of the races in 55 and 6, so... You know, there's no telling there, but
my cell phone just told me Jack Walker is nearby.
Cool. So close you can see him.
That's scary.
Yeah, it is.
I'll tell you an interesting today. This morning, a fellow walked in the CarQuest store in Shallotte and grinning from ear to ear, says, "Y'all come out here. I got something I want to show you." And we walked outside and found a brand new looking 1961 Dodge Seneca four-door sedan, and it looked brand new. Had a slant six, power steering, power brakes, and Chrysler's version of add-on air conditioning. And the thing was just almost showroom.
Have y'all ever seen a picture of Bill France sitting on top of a totally demolished car?
I have seen that picture.
That says Red Boats Garage and so on and so forth. That car was a Graham Page. That was the brand name of the car. So Dargan Watts put on there that this is that the Graham Page, 1940 Graham Page Hollywood supercharged sedan. Only 200 of these were ever made in the world. And they demolished one of them.
Now, was that a Daytona in a race?
I don't know where it could have.
That picture's at High Point.
Yeah, that's right. You're exactly right. High Point in the 1940s.
The thing with the Grahams, they're very interesting to me because I love the look of the cars, but I try and do as much research on Raymond Parks as possible. So Raymond owned that car. Somehow Bill France sold him on the idea that a Graham would be better than a Ford V8. So he bought it, they raced it, he flipped it, done whatever damage to it. I've seen footage from 1942 of that Graham. I wouldn't think they'd go out and buy another one, being as they only made 200. But I've seen some footage from 41 and early 42 of that car with Bill France driving. And then in 1950, Raymond sponsored a local driver named Tex Keen at the Peach Bowl in the weekly division, and he drove a Graham. So I wouldn't think that it's the same car for the whole, you know, 12-year span, but you never know.
Yeah, you're right, Cody. The one that Bill France wrecked was the Red Boat Raymond Parks race car at High Point in the 1940s. Boy, she looks total.
Yep. 5/10 of all the Grahams ever made right there.
Yeah, right there.
Right there, one pile.
But all that Georgia connection to that model makes it kind of like a Graham cracker, right?
Oh, yeah. See, where's that been lately, Tim?
Where's what been?
All those puns of yours.
Oh, they've been around.
They've been there. They're just in your head, right? Sometimes they get out.
Yeah. You know, that's talking about my grandson's soccer games. I sit up on the sidelines and I make up poems against the other teams.
Are you serious?
I did. And I did one last week that just had the entire grandstands in almost total shock, and the players on the field were about to roll over laughing. But anyway.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap it. Thanks, guys. Appreciate all of you very much. Thanks for helping put this together. And we thanks to all you fans for helping us keep this thing going. We appreciate you, too. As always, we're going to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve in the military. Thank you for doing what you do so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night, and God bless.
The best racers came into town back then, 'cause the fairgrounds was the place, where the red dirt was hard by the old railroad yard, and their glorious dreams they chased. Buck Baker, the flocks, were racing the clock, as did Petty and Fireball too.